I want to begin with a song. I'm not going to sing it, but you're invited to sing along once you get the hang of this. It's a song by Mason Jennings, and it's called, "Oh Jesus, I Love You, and I Love Buddha Too." Oh Jesus, I love you, and I love Buddha too, Ramakrishna, Guru Dev, Tao Te Ching, and Muhammad. Why do some people say that there is just one way to love you, God, and come to you? We are all a part of you. You are unnameable, you are unknowable. All we have is metaphor, that's what time and space are for. Is the universe your thought? You are one, and you are not. You are many, you are one, ever-ending, just begun. All right? All right? All right? I love you and Buddha, too.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Oh, Jesus, I love you.
Sing along.
And I love Buddha, too. Ramakrishna, Guru,
turn it up.
Dadaji, and Muhammad.
Isn't that fun? Mason Jennings, I Love You and Buddha Too. Today, compare and contrast. In the Dona Sutra, there's a story about the Buddha that has an exciting parallel with Jesus in the Gospel of Mark. Now, the Gospel of Mark story, you might know, Jesus has just finished doing some miracles, and he's walking along with his disciples, and he asks them, "Who do you say that I am?" And here's the text from Mark 8, beginning with verse 28. And they answered him, "Well, John the Baptist." And others said, "Elijah." And still others, "One of the prophets." And then Jesus asked them, "But who do you say that I am?" And Peter answered him, "Well, you're the Messiah." And Jesus sternly ordered them not to tell anyone about it. Then he began to teach them that the Son of Man must undergo great suffering and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the scribes, and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. He said all this quite openly, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But turning and looking at his disciples, Jesus rebuked Peter and said, "Get behind me, Satan, for you are setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things." And then he called the crowd and the disciples, and he said to them, "If any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves, take up their cross, and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it. And those who lose their life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel will save it." Now that is a central text for the Gospel of Mark. It's central in that it's right in the middle. Mark has 16 chapters. This is from chapter 8. But it's also central in this text. We hear the centrality of the author of Mark's author of the Gospel of Mark's message. This is who Jesus is, what it means to follow him, and thus the meaning, purpose, and goal of life. And it starts out about being about Jesus, but it ends up about being about you and me. Jesus says cryptically, "For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel, the sake of the good news, will save it." Now, I think that's tough to get your head around. Peter doesn't get it. The Messiah suffers, is crucified, rises again. That doesn't make any sense. And then Jesus never really affirms who he is. Peter calls him the Messiah, and in response, Jesus just says, "Don't tell anybody." Now, Messiah in Greek means Christos or Christ. That's how Jesus is called, the Christ, the Messiah. It actually literally means anointed one. That is someone who's been, you know, anointed or ordained to go and do some task, usually heroic task. David, King David, was anointed to lead the kingdom of Israel, etc. We all have a longing for a hero or a heroine to come and make things right. Politicians bank on this. "I'll make America great again," yada yada. This is a common longing, to wait for someone to come and fix it. In the time of Jesus, someone to come, defeat the Romans, make Israel great again, yada yada. When Peter says that Jesus is the Messiah or the Christ, Jesus doesn't say yes or no. He says, "Don't tell anybody," which is kind of strange. It's as if Jesus is saying, "Don't call me a Messiah because you have no idea what that means." Then he uses a wholly, totally different phrase, "Son of God," or "Son of Man," excuse me, "Son of Man," which might be a synonym for Messiah, or maybe it just means what it is literally, a child of the human, you know, a child of Adam. The son of a human being? A human being? I don't know. The human being, the Messiah, will suffer, be rejected, crucified, then after 3 days rise again. Peter says that's not a good answer. That doesn't fit his plot of how things need to shake out, or as they say now, that doesn't conform with the narrative. But Jesus pushes back and he says, "Get behind me, Satan." Now we should bracket that word Satan. It's not about later Christian mythology of the devil and the horns and the fallen angel and all of that stuff. The Satan, or the adversary, actually served on God's team up in the heavenly court and would come down and hassle people to test them, like he tested Job or tested Jesus in the wilderness. And that's the sense here. The Satan goes around and pushes their buttons to see if they've really got the stuff. So Peter, in Jesus' mind, is taking up the role of the Satan by saying, "You don't have to do that stuff. Crosses, suffering, nah." And Jesus says, "No, get behind me. I got to stay focused." I think that's kind of the sense of it. Then Jesus puts it to all of them, his disciples and to the whole crowd. "If you want to follow me, you too must take up the cross. You want to save your life? Lose it. If you lose it for my sake in the gospel, that is for this path of the cross, you'll save it." It's a cryptic message. It is hard to get our heads around it. Even harder to actually do. What does it mean to take up your cross? Does it mean like my grandma used to say or something? "Oh, that's the cross I have to bear." "The point of the Christian walk is to be miserable for the Lord." I don't know. It's something important. What are we really supposed to do? Is it literal? Is it metaphorical? Is it half and half? And what about this business of rising again in 3 days? Does just the Messiah, the Son of Man, Jesus, get to do that? Or will those who follow him do it too? I don't know. People have been dying on crosses and other means for a long, long time. I don't see him rising. Is this some future thing? It's supposed to happen in another 14 billion years or after we're dead? Do you have to die on a cross first? Or do we just go this way and believe that Jesus did it and then your bases are covered? I don't find this particularly easy. And as I say that, my detractors will say that's because you're a false teacher. You aren't saved, and so on. And that may be true. But I also think that many preachers and theologians are a bunch of snake oil peddlers selling superstitions. And they don't know any more than you do or I do. They say you have to believe this or believe that in order to get to heaven. And I think a lot of it's a bunch of theological gobbledygook. And I bet you do too when you think about it. It keeps people feeling bad about themselves because they have doubts or questions. And it serves to keep people passive and obedient, doubting themselves and their own creativity and their own questioning. And these experts take one verse here and another there and make a whole theological system that, in my opinion, turns the text into something other than what it is, tortures it. All that said, I think this text in Mark 8 is a fascinating piece of literature. It's compelling, and it has a pull, but I'm not sure exactly what it means, not only intellectually, but more importantly, what it means for me personally. But I can't let it go, and I know that it has a hold on me. Haunting words: take up your cross, follow me, lose your life to save it. So I'm going to let that text sit there with us for a little bit and then dabble in some Buddhism and then come back. The Dona Sutra tells the story of an encounter with the Buddha, or the Blessed One. And in this story, the Buddha is like Jesus, and he's walking along the road. And a Brahmin, that's a holy man or a priest, is following him. And he sees the Buddha's footprints, wheels with 1,000 spokes together with rims and hubs, complete in all their features. These are the Buddha's footprints. And he says, "Well, this cannot be a human being." Now, let me take a side view here for a second. Buddha and Jesus were probably historical figures who had layers of legend attached to them. I doubt that the historical Buddha made these footprints. I doubt that the historical Jesus walked on water. I do think that both figures, however, had a gravitational pull that attracted people to them and to their message or way of living, and that resulted in ascribing miracles to them. Less important. Whether you believe in supernatural miracles or not, it's not the important thing. I think what they taught and did was important, and that's what was attractive. And so the miracle stories were attached. Anyway, in the story, Dona, the Brahmin, follows Buddha, follows the tracks. And then he finds Buddha sitting tranquilly under a tree. He's just chilling, doing his Buddha thing. And the text says that Buddha was confident, inspiring confidence, his senses calmed, his mind calmed, having attained the utmost control and tranquility, tamed, guarded, his senses restrained. All right. So then the Dhamma, the Brahmin, goes up to him and says, "Master, are you a deva?" "No, Brahmin, I'm not a deva." "Are you a Gandhava?" "No." "A Yaksha?" "No." "A human being?" "No, Brahmin, I'm not a human being." Now, deva, Gandhava, and Yaksha are different kinds of divine beings around believed in that time. Or mortals with superpowers. Buddha says, no, he's not any of those things. And he also says no to whether or not he's a human being. So then the Brahmin asks him, "Well, what kind of being are you?" And Buddha says, and I'm paraphrasing this, "If I were any of those things, all right, gods or mortals or whatever, or even human beings, I would be subject to future arising." Had to get kind of the system. That is reincarnation. Getting on the wheel, never getting off. Back again, back again. Reincarnation is not a fun thing. You got to know that. People think, oh, wouldn't we be able to come back as a prince of Egypt or whatever? No. You want to get off the wheel. Stop coming around. That's the Hindu system. It's like the Brahmin who looked up at a tree and said, how many? It's just been revealed to me. They'd only have as many lives as there are leaves on this tree. You know, millions. I mean, that's what suffering is, going around and around, having to keep coming back. Do it again. Do it again. So you want to get off the wheel, according to the Hindu philosophy. All right. So that's what Buddha says. He's not any of those things. And if he were any of those things, he'd still be on the wheel. So he's abandoned those things, one life to another. He's cut that all off. And he's not identified with anything. And then the Buddha says, just like a red, blue, or white lotus, born in the water, grown in the water, rising up above the water, stands unsmeared by the water. In the same way, I, born in the world, grown in the world, having overcome the world, sounds like Jesus, lives unsmeared by the world. Remember me, Brahman, as awakened. And then he goes on. The fermentation by which I would go into a deva state or become a grandhava in the sky or go to a yaka state and a human state, those have been destroyed. No more of that stuff. Ruined. Their stems, removed. Like a blue lotus rising up, unsmeared by water, unsmeared am I by the world, and so, Brahman, I'm awake. And that's Buddha's answer. Who are you? I'm awake. Another tough passage to get your heads around, and perhaps even harder to live out. Buddha is not identified with any category. He's transcended all of these identities, not because he's magic, not because he's divine, but because he is awake. So the invitation to us from Buddha is be awake. Wake up. The invitation from Jesus to us is lose your lives so you can find them. Question for discussion. Are these invitations similar or are they different? Are they complementary or are they contrasting? Do we take up a cross? Do we become a lotus? Or both? Must one be right and the other wrong? Does one path inform the other? Questions for further discussion, come back and give a report. But I do find it helpful to find wisdom wherever it may be found. And I think that the religious quest, or the spiritual quest, for those who don't like the word religion, is to take what we can and then ask, to what is this invitation? To what am I being invited to do with my life? Personally, I want to follow Jesus, and I want to be awake. I love Jesus and Buddha too. I'm probably neither awake or following very well. But I still have this day and maybe even more to give it a go. Religion, in my opinion, and that's all it is, my opinion, take it or leave it, my opinion is that religion is a beautiful and magnificent thing. At its best, it invites us to redefine ourselves, to not be captured by identities for which we've grown up with, to challenge all self-definitions, to engage in an exciting quest, to live with depth, to recognize illusions, to awaken, to not cling to a version of self that's destructive, but like a snake, to shed the skin and be reborn, to contribute to this world, this wild, amazing human existence on this beautiful planet. And we have whatever time we have to do it. I find it personally tedious to worry about what others think I should do or believe. Don't you? I deal with the tedium by making light of it. Try to be like a lotus, rise above it. I find it actually abusive to try to manipulate people into thinking or believing in things in order to get them to think they're going to get some reward or punishment if they don't. Religion's too important for that. It's too important to be left to the zealots. The symbols of religion, they play with one another, and they cross paths. So I think it's fruitful to take a religious text and compare it with one from another tradition. See what grows. So to pick up a cross, like Dietrich Bonhoeffer did, to give up his position at Union Theological Seminary, go back to Germany and take on the Nazis. Or to awake, like Thich Nhat Hanh, and also a work for social justice and enlightenment in his place. Yes, yes, two different traditions. Pick up the cross, awaken. Not that we have to be those people or be great or think we have to be, you know, something magnificent or something they're going to write books about. No, be us. Live the life we have with wakefulness, with not clinging, with experiencing the suffering in a way that acknowledges it and yet transcends it. To pick up the cross, to rise. Our religious stories are not about things that happened or things that must be believed, but about ways of happening in our present. So I think these stories, Mark chapter 8 about Jesus and the Dona Sutra about Buddha, have really some interesting parallels and points of intersection. They contrast as well. Buddha does not want to rise again, right? He doesn't want to go. Jesus does, because he's in a world in which you don't do that. You get one shot, he wants to keep going. What does rising mean for each of them? Jesus picks up the cross to engage suffering. Buddha meditates to transcend suffering. Yet both are of the world, not defined by it. Who are they? They both refuse any definition. Lose your life to save it, be awake. And as a lovely irony, I chose the text where Jesus is about to be arrested to complete his task that he spoke of, to suffer, be crucified. He prays and he tells his disciples to be awake, and they sleep. Now, we can take that story at face value. Well, he just wanted them to be awake with him. But I think with the insights from the Buddha story, I play with the idea that Jesus is inviting the disciples to awake in a Buddhist sense, to transcend identities put upon us. And why? Why would you want to do that? Well, you do that so you can live freely, so you can be present to what is at hand, and to be present to who is at hand, to be awake, to carry the cross. living a life that's engaged, like a lotus, unencumbered, so that one can be with, be present with, feel with, live with compassion, feeling with, which is probably the highest value for both Jesus and Buddha. I took in a lot of weird places today. In part because I think that religion is really a cool thing, and I'm tired of it just being such a bummer and doing bad things, killing people or making people think they gotta believe this or that or the other, when it's so much more interesting of having these wonderful texts and wonderful figures to speak to us in our present, that we might actually live lives that are wakeful and mindful, as well as willing to let whatever it is that we have go. I'm gonna close with one more story. This is an illustration of both following the cross and being awake, I think. And it's from another tradition, the Jewish tradition, from the Talmud. And this is a story that was told by Henry Nouwen in his book, Wounded Healer. A rabbi asked Elijah, "When will the Messiah come?" And Elijah replied, "Well, go and ask him yourself." "Well, where is he?" "Well, he's sitting at the gates of the city." "Well, how will I know which one is him?" And the rabbi said, or Elijah said, "He's sitting among the poor, covered with wounds. The others unbind all their wounds at the same time and then bind them all up again. But he unbinds one at a time and binds it up again, saying to himself, 'Perhaps I shall be needed. If so, I must always be ready so as not to delay for a moment.'" I have no definitive answer on these texts or what you ought to do with your life. But I love these texts, and they speak to me in a way that says, be awake. Be willing to lose it to save it.